Good morning, everyone. This is Deja from the Science Media Center. Welcome to this online briefing on the census of marine life, the release of papers entitled What Lives in the Sea. We're very fortunate this morning to have the lead author of the Global Synthesis Report, which is part of that decade-long effort to catalog the immense biodiversity in the oceans. The lead author there is Dr. Mark Costello, who is based at Lee Marine Laboratory at the University of Auckland. He's a specialist in marine ecology, biogeography, and biodiversity, and has been involved in a very large number of different projects which are all attempting to put to use the resources available with online now and also with various developments in informatics to try to systematically categorize all of these marine creatures and other areas of biodiversity as well. So such projects as the Global Biodiversity Information Facility, the World Register of Marine Species, the Ocean Biogeographic Information System, and et cetera, several others. Our second speaker today will be Dr. Alison McDermid, who's Principal Scientist in Marine Ecology at NIWA in Wellington. And Dr. McDermid worked on the local portion of this release, the paper which focused on the marine biodiversity of Aotearoa, New Zealand, and that's what she'll be speaking on today. So to get things started, just one housekeeping note. If you could please hold any questions that you have till the end, I will hand over to our speakers, and I will be muting all the other conference participants during that portion just to improve the audio quality on the line. If you do have any questions as we go through and you'd like to make note of that, you can see in the upper left-hand portion of your screen there is a chat box. Just feel free to type your name into that box to let me know that you have a question, and I will call on you when we get to the Q&A session at the end. So I'll now hand over to Dr. Mark Costello, our first speaker.
Hello, everybody. Just tell me if you can't hear me, because I'm using a speakerphone here. And I presume everybody can read the slides that are online, so I won't repeat everything that's in the slides. That'll help us move through them a little bit more quickly. I'm the lead author on one of 12 papers published in the Public Library of Science, one journal, PLOS One, which is an open access journal, so all the information is immediately available, well, will be immediately available as of tomorrow to everybody past the embargo date. And the Census of Marine Life was 10 years long, and in that 10 years, there's been two other kind of issues have been burning. One is that scientists have been arguing that there's been a gradual dwindling of expertise in the basic taxonomy of how to identify and discover species. And the second is increasing evidence of major declines in many fish populations, especially those that are being overfished, up to 90% of some of these populations being lost. And people have been wondering, so here we can't even discover what's in the oceans, and now we're losing what's in the oceans before we've even put names on many of these species. So this is one of the reasons the census got started, to try and bring together the marine expertise and see what's out there. So the Census of Marine Life on the second slide shows you the regions covered by the census, mainly the exclusive economic zones. So the open oceans are a little bit left out of part of these papers. And the next slide coming up. So I've got some statistics there on the Census of Marine Life. It's pretty much the largest marine biology global program ever, involved many countries, thousands of scientists over the last year. And the next slide is just what I've already said about the dwindling taxonomic expertise and evidence of declines in biodiversity. And the main conclusions then from the study was we believe we know about 230,000 marine species, but there's probably at least three or four times that number of species that have yet to be described. We found that half of all the species are crustaceans, mollusks, and fish, and that the proportions of these taxa do vary quite a lot around the world. So in the past, people have extrapolated from saying, well, the proportion of species in, you know, Northern Europe or the North Atlantic or some well-known place is probably the same everywhere, and we can assume the following. So I don't think we can make those assumptions so easily going forward. There's some lovely slides of the Census of Marine Life website from the embargo. I have a few pictures there of some of the more extraordinary creatures, from worms that live on dead whale bones to planktonic organisms. There's the burglar alarm jellyfish, which apparently lights up like a burglar alarm when it's disturbed. And in terms of alien species, we looked at threats to biodiversity, and the main threats were overfishing, pollution and habitat loss, which is probably no surprise because there's been much evidence from within countries and local and regional areas that these are issues. But now we've shown that it's the same issue all over the world. And alien species we looked at as well. And the Mediterranean topped the list. This is due to the Suez Canal providing a you know, constant pathway now for species to invade the Mediterranean from the Red Sea and the Indian Ocean. But there's many invasive species in other countries, and New Zealand, Europe and Australia seem to have the highest numbers of invasive species. Now, whether that's true or it's because these are the best studied areas remains to be seen. In terms of richness, Australia and Japan topped the list of over 32,000 species. China was close second to 22,000. But if you look at species, not just in terms of the numbers of species, the reason those areas had a lot of species is probably because they span a huge range of climatic areas. Australia going from the Antarctic up to the tropics, Japan going to the tropics to almost the subarctic or the cold temperate regions. But if you look at the species that are unique to each area, New Zealand and Antarctica, almost half the species in New Zealand and Antarctica are unique to those areas. About 28% to Australia and South Africa and over 20% in South America. So the Southern Hemisphere has a lot more unique species. I thought I'd better throw in a graph to show you we did some science. There's lots more graphs in the paper. But some of the relationships we found were a bit disappointing. One was that we didn't find a very good species-area relationship. And normally, the bigger the area you look, the more samples you take, the more species you get. But this wasn't the case in the sea, and this is because many areas of the sea aren't sampled, so we're only sampling a small proportion of them. I mentioned the main threats, overfishing being top of the list. And if the most threatened regions are the enclosed seas, like the Mediterranean, the Gulf of Mexico, the Baltic Sea, and the China Sea, which also have very high densities of human populations surrounding them. So then we looked at what we don't know. And what we don't know is that there's thousands of species and specimen collections which are not even described yet. We've already collected the species. We don't have the resources to describe and name them quickly. But there's hundreds of thousands of species out there. Probably we reckon there's over 1 million, maybe 1.4 million marine species, and we've only described about 230,000. The areas of the ocean that are least well known, not surprisingly, are the deep sea and the smaller invertebrates. And surprisingly, these gaps are the same in developed and developing countries, so we've got some common issues there. I have a couple of slides there from the Science Marine Life website of species that only occurred in the Baltic and other new species that were discovered as part of the census. So to try and simplify what we found, we're still looking in terms of biodiversity at the tip of the iceberg, and much of the iceberg is hidden from us. We don't even know what's there. Okay, and if people are wondering, so what? Is that important to look at all these things? Well, it's the essence of science and discovery to go out and find out what's there. Then you can decide, you know, what resources you should put into doing research and these other things. Because just basically knowing what's out there is probably the first thing people ever started doing once we could observe nature. Many potential food sources, pests as well, understanding how nature works, understanding biology, and of course all this biodiversity is what provides the food resources and the healthy ecosystems that we depend on. Okay. I have a slide there about whether we can afford this research. That's not entirely our question, but in some ways it's not the most expensive research in the world. It's a matter of organizing the field expeditions and the laboratory work. So probably the biggest cost of this are people's time. And this is also great political significance because the Convention on Biological Diversity has continuously come up and said we need more emphasis on the marine environment, but they haven't had a global marine biological assessment. And in a way, we've provided a baseline for such an assessment. And the global ecosystem assessment, as it was called, only barely touched on marine species, and that is only some of the commonly fished species that they had information to hand. But now we've shown that hundreds of scientists from around the world can collaborate and produce papers to a common standard, have them peer-reviewed and published. And if we made some recommendations at the end of the paper, I just summarize them in 3 points here. What will help resolve the situation? Well, I think the most important thing is being online species identification guides. Many identification guides are still produced as large books, which are expensive and not widely distributed. But if we had more identification guides and they were online, then you could open up this whole field to the public and amateurs and students and everybody much more quickly, and that would generate a lot more discoveries, rather like astronomy has. Astronomy now has amateurs community. We show that international collaboration can happen, and obviously modern working practice. So even the publication of this in an open access journal is an indication of, and this, all these papers have been peer-reviewed and published and prepared within the space of the last 4 months. So it shows how quickly things can be done nowadays. Normally, you might have to wait a year or two to get a paper published. And I think that is about the end. I've just a couple of concluding slides there. And also I put the link to the website where there's some lovely videos. If any of you have your own website, you want to make links to those in the videos that accompany this press release. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mark. I'll hand to our second speaker now, Dr. Alison McDermott.
Hi there. I'll just click my slides up. Hold on. Okay, so Mark's given the broad context for the work that we undertook locally within our New Zealand EEZ, Exclusive Economic Zone. I'm one of the co-authors on this paper that Dennis Gordon led. And I'll just quickly take you through the major results from this paper and conclude with some implications for management of this work. Okay, so a quick summary of what we have got here. It's generally recognised that New Zealand has a particularly rich marine flora and fauna, and that there are over 17,000 known living species within our EEZ. But this diversity includes over 4,000 known species that we recognise as species, but they're still sitting in our collections undescribed. And we think there are probably at least another 17,000 species yet to be discovered in our waters, and mainly due to the fact that we're exploring much of our marine habitat for the first time, particularly the deeper areas below 2,000 metres are relatively very poorly explored so far. And whenever we go into these areas, we're picking up lots of new species. Okay, the most diverse groups within our marine flora and fauna are listed here, include the mollusks, the bivalves and snails, etc., with over 3,500 species. The arthropods, the crabs, lobsters, barnacles, shrimps, those sorts of things, almost 3,000 species. The chordates, which include the fish, the sharks, the mammals, the birds, all those things with backbones. The sponges, and a group called the cnidarians, which includes the corals, the gorgonians, the jellyfish and the hydroids, those sorts of things, with over 1,000 known species. And as Mark said earlier, the level of endemism or species not occurring elsewhere is very high in our part of the world. About half of our species are endemic. But this level of endemism varies from a high 95% in sponges and some other groups to much lower levels amongst other groups, which are much more highly migratory. That includes the marine mammals and the tunas and that sort of thing. But there are also some very poorly known groups in New Zealand because we've haven't done much work on them so far, or we've got no local expertise, and that includes certainly the marine bacteria. Very poorly known groups worldwide, but the work that has been done indicates that we're likely to have thousands, if not tens of thousands, of different bacterial groups within our marine waters. A lot of these are very highly specialised. So you may have heard something about the marine bacteria which specialise in living in hot vents, and which are the basis of chemosynthetic ecosystems around hot vents and cold seeps. And we've certainly got those in our New Zealand waters. But there are some other groups, reasonably large size animals, flatworms, nematodes, that sort of thing. We're talking millimetres here in terms of largeness, but certainly a lot larger than bacteria. And also the parasitic protozoan are particularly poorly known. And we've also got some very poorly sampled regions. We've already mentioned that the deep water habitats below about 2,000 metres are very poorly known. But also the west coasts of both main islands, often in quite shallow water, remain very poorly sampled. And that's due in part to the rougher waters inshore along those areas, and the lack of harbours and easily accessed points along those coasts. So there's lots of work to be done, even in quite shallow zones. Now, there's probably some good reasons why we've got quite high levels of marine biodiversity and endemism within the New Zealand EEZ. Certainly, our isolation in the Southwest Pacific has been a contributing cause. So that flow of genes from species elsewhere in the Pacific is very limited because we've got no shallow water connections. Other coastlines are a long way away. And also because we've got a particularly rich and varied seascape. So if you look at the map that's behind the words there on the slide, you can see that we've got our seascapes range from the shallow sheltered mangrove forests in the far north and to the second deepest part of the ocean in the Kermadec Trench. We've got lots of canyons. We've got lots of sediment channels. We've got a deeply incised shelf edge with lots of canyon features. We've got seamounts, and so it's all those things are a result of our position on the active plate boundaries between the Pacific and the Australian plates, and the very vigorous tectonic events that occur in our neck of the world. And it's also because we're a long, thin country, and we go from the subtropical waters or up by the Kermadec down to much cooler waters to the far south. So all these things mean that we've got lots of different places for lots of different species to actually develop in isolation from other places. And as Mark indicated, from a global point of view, locally we've got some real threats to our marine habitats. And we've recently been looking at these in quite a lot of detail in a new project. And we've identified the top 10 threats to New Zealand marine habitats, and they're listed here in decreasing order of importance. So at the top there are a couple of threats which largely stem from international threats associated with climate change. And you can see that those are in blue there, and there are five of those in the top 10 list. And really, apart from documenting their impact, we can't do too much about those because we're totally dependent on global initiatives to reverse their effect. However, the remaining five top threats and all the other, many of the other 60-odd threats that we looked at in this particular study many of those are under New Zealand's control, and we can actually do something about them. So in conclusion then, I think there are some implications for management from our finding. The large number of species in New Zealand waters indicates that the responsibilities of our management agencies are also great. Certainly the large proportion of species still undescribed underscores the need to fully document our marine diversity. But as Mark said, globally, certainly in New Zealand, this will be very difficult to achieve within this important diagnostic, really, within current levels of funding and expertise. I think we're at our lowest ebb in terms of taxonomic expertise since the Second World War, which doesn't place us in a good state to really take advantage of and understand New Zealand's the contribution of New Zealand's marine biodiversity to a whole range of ecosystem goods and services that they support. It also means that the high level of endemism means that we can't rely on other countries to do this work for us. We're responsible for a huge range of species which are unique to our part of the world. And so this need for self-reliance needs to be translated into policies and management actions, which means that the integrity and the long-term stability and sustainability of the environments and habitats in which our marine diversity occurs is maintained. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Alison. I'll open the floor up to questions now. Give me one moment while I unmute all of you so that we would be able to hear your questions. One second. All right, go ahead. Is there a question from the audience?
Kent Atkinson at NZPA.
Go ahead, Kent.
I was interested in the biodiversity around New Zealand's coasts in the sense mm-hmm. that so many of the coastal fish populations close to the coast seem to rely heavily on spawning areas or breeding areas either in estuaries or marshes along the coast. And I was curious as to what importance Alison, for instance, would place on stewardship of these land links or the material going into the near coastal waters from the land in terms of its impact on these close to shore species. One example would be the snapper along the west coast. It's been shown that an enormous proportion of these are actually bred up in one area of the Hokianga.
Hi, it's Alison here. And in fact, that's from the Kaipara. It looks like the Kaipara, at least in the 1 year that we looked at that, or Mark Morrison from NIWA in Auckland looked at that. They did, I think, something like 90% of the snapper on the west coast were spending a period of their very early juvenile life in seagrass beds and that sort of habitat within the Kaipara Harbour. And you're right, it does underscore the need for excellent stewardship of those sorts of places. I think one of the problems in the past is that we've been blind to how important those sorts of places are. And they've been convenient dumping grounds for all sorts of things. So our land use practices, you're absolutely right, they have implications, they have consequences for all sorts of aspects of our marine environment. So sedimentation, what we do on land in terms of land use practices has consequences in terms of how much sediment comes down the rivers and ends up in the nearshore harbours and estuaries and perhaps further out across the shelf. And similarly with the nutrients that we put on our land and the sorts of things that get put into stormwater drains and end up in rivers and ultimately in the nearshore areas. So, and I think that underscores the need for both some sort of integrated management of our land and our seas. It can't be an either-or thing, but that's how we've tended to apply our management in the past.
As a follow-up to that, the Ministry of Fisheries is looking at opening up standing seaweeds to living seaweeds to harvest for a number of species. Do you think there's enough known about the importance of those to the biodiversity along our coasts to allow for that kind of activity without further knowledge of how important various seaweed populations are to different forms of marine life?
Well, there's seaweed harvesting going on now, of course, and you know, I think what the entry of seaweeds into the quota system could do is put a real limit on how much is taken as we explore what the consequences might actually be. So my understanding from the Ministry of what the Ministry of Fisheries is trying to achieve is to put a lid on how much is actually being harvested to a very low level, and at the same time undertaking these necessary studies to figure out what the impacts might actually be. But certainly to figure out what the impacts might be, you'll actually have to allow some harvesting to take place, almost like a large-scale experiment. And as long as those sorts of things are put in place, I can't see too much wrong with allowing some harvesting to take place now.
Thank you.
This is James Frankham, Geographic.
Go ahead, James.
Just wondering, Alison, maybe Mark also could reflect on this. Do you think that part of the lack of funding and expertise in this area is possibly due to the fact that it's fundamental scientific research, and so, you know, discovering another 10,000 species of nematodes is unlikely to sort of render a new fishery or have a GDP outcome? What other sort of economic cases can be built around this sort of work?
I think it's been largely because we haven't been aware of the ecosystem goods and services that biodiversity per se actually supplies us. So, for instance, you can think of these services in three different types. First, there are regulatory sorts of services. So biodiversity is important in terms of things like climate regulation, in carbon capture and sequestration, in detoxification of pollutants, in amelioration of tsunami and storm surge, as was evident in Indonesia a few years ago, in terms of water quality maintenance and storage of cycling of nutrients and etc. And the second area would be in things like provisioning services. So biodiversity supplies the raw materials, if you want to put it that way, in terms of fishable species, in terms of aquaculture species, in terms of biological compounds, which can be used in fighting cancer and that sort of thing, in terms of wild genes, which have got novel applications. And the other third way they can be looked at is in terms of the sort of non-consumptive services and things like biodiversity supplies the sorts of wildlife that we can watch from land and air or from boats or from via diving. They supply the subjects of scientific research. They also can indicate the health of ecosystems. There are foci for education, and I think also they can be seen as supplying the marine biological components of seascapes which enhance coastal land value. So, for instance, people like to live by the sea because there's nice clean water and it's access to Kaimoana and those sorts of things. So, and those all depend on a healthy, functioning ecosystem filled with the sorts of critters which actually clean the water and which do all those things to which make it an attractive place to actually buy our property. So in combination, all those things, I think if people had a better feel for the sorts of you know, the actual very tangible things that biodiversity in its broader sense actually provides us. They'd actually appreciate them much more.
Right, no, thanks for that. I mean, I know that, I think that Tangaroa trip with the camel voyage down to the Ross Sea cost about $6.5 million for the New Zealand taxpayers, and that was before any research took place. But you're suggesting that, you know, that's a dot to compared with what actually might be a priceless services that are supplied.
Right, absolutely. You know, the more we learn about just in Antarctica, we're learning more and more that it's a really critical part in how this planet functions. And certainly the living components of that are an important part of that whole functioning ecosystem. Without these things, our planet would be not a very pleasant place to live, and maybe, in fact, impossible for us to live here. So it's knowing how these things work and bringing them to people's attention as much is critical, especially these days, as because some of the very basic functions and we're becoming much more aware of how they're being damaged by our own action.
Right. Thanks very much.
Yeah, I think I could add a little. It's also one of the most, it's fundamental, but also one of the most applied sciences, because in terms of diagnostics, if you want to know what pest or disease or some other problem is, or a new food item, then you need to be able to identify it properly. NIWA has a great strength in this type of diagnostics within New Zealand. And it becomes very hard then to separate the line about what's fundamental and what's applied, because it's like if you want to develop a new car, you can fund research on cars, but you also need the research on the chemistry and materials and properties of those materials that you need to build better cars. And it's just the same with biodiversity. You need knowledge right into the basics of the fundamentals of how ecosystems are built.
Great. Are there any more questions from those who've dialed in?
Ken Atkinson here at NZPA. I was curious about were there any implications specifically for New Zealand in terms of the new awareness of how plankton species are formed to give the huge biodiversity that we see in the oceans. Is there anything peculiar to New Zealand in terms of, for instance, the nutrient-rich waters that come up from the circumpolar current past New Zealand that is relevant to this, or to the wider issue of biodiversity in the seas around New Zealand?
I think the thing that we've noticed in the study is the number of endemic species in New Zealand is half the fauna, and as Ali has said, this parallels in a way what's on land. So I don't think people have appreciated how much of the marine species around New Zealand are endemic and unusual to this area. But Ali might want to comment on the productivity aspects as well.
Well, certainly the Southern Ocean is a very productive area. I don't fully understand your question. Mentioned something about phytoplankton.
Well, I'm sorry. What's in the back of my mind is that New Zealand waters are relatively isolated from other coasts, and I wondered whether the gene flow between New Zealand waters and distant coasts is enhanced by the currents that flow up past New Zealand towards the tropics, or whether it's something of a special case in terms of biodiversity in the oceans. Because of our geographic isolation.
Okay, so in terms of oceanic things like copepods, there are a few endemic species here, species not found anywhere else, but there's such a broad mixing that many, many, many of our pelagic species tend to be found over a much broader ocean basin type scale, or in fact, some of them appear to be cosmopolitan across many oceans. And so I don't think there's a special case to be pleaded in terms of our pelagic ecosystems.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Right. Well, thank you very much to both of our speakers. I would like to highlight that this information is still under global embargo, and it will remain so until 9 a.m. tomorrow morning, New Zealand time. If you would like to refer to the slides, in particular, those are now all available in the resource library at the Science Media Center. You can download a copy there. If you need any help with the login, just get in touch with the Science Media Center. And if you'd like to follow up with interviews with other of our speakers, contact us and we will help get you in touch. So thank you very much for joining us, and this now concludes our briefing.